What can you learn from a 16th century British castle? More than you might expect, especially when that castle is Hampton Court Palace, the setting for some of the most important events in British history. Now, that history has been brought to life in the new book, The Palace, From the Tudors to the Windsors, 500 Years of British History at Hampton Court, by Gareth Russell. Gareth is a historian, author, and broadcaster who hosts the podcast Single Malt History. Here he is to share five of his key insights.
Hello, my name is Gareth Russell, and I'm the author of the new book, The Palace, From the Tudors to the Windsors, 500 Years of British History at Hampton Court, the beautiful entrance gate to which you can see on the cover. I'm immensely flattered to be here. Thank you very much for having me. Picking out five anecdotes over the course of Hampton Court's five centuries to share with you was great fun. I was continually shocked and fascinated as I was researching the book. And so I hope the palace is really an arc of history that I've been able to share with you, the readers. I was incredibly lucky and equally grateful to be allowed to walk around Hampton Court after closing time by Historic Royal Palaces. That is the charity which, in partnership with the monarchy, runs Hampton Court as a museum today. And with that, we shall move on to the five lesser-known anecdotes about Hampton Court, which I hope entertain and inform. There is an enduring idea that the lives of those in the medieval era were an unending litany of the rancid and the repulsive. Certainly, hygiene levels were a lot lower than they are today. But the long-standing legend that people never really washed is just that, a legend, a myth. While researching Chapter 1 of The Palace, I focused on the lives of servants who worked there in the early 1500s, and I uncovered records of how they slept, how they cleaned themselves, and the very strict guides on how they were allowed to dispose of leftovers in their food, went to the toilet, and made sure their breath didn't stink. Morning breath reeked as badly in 1503 as it does in 2023, and nobody liked it then either. The servants slept in dormitories, most of them in what we would call sleeping bags. They were then laid on bundles of rushes that, if you put them together in the exact way that medieval and Tudor domestic guidebooks tell you to, are surprisingly, and I really do mean surprisingly, comfortable. It is true that bathing, as in full immersion or like in a bathtub, as we would think of bathing, was quite rare. But that was partly to do with the limits of plumbing and the difficulty in heating the water. During her time at Hampton Court, the impossibly chic Queen Anne Boleyn did have a personal bathtub installed with hot and cold running water. The water for her baths was heated on the other side of the bathroom wall by coal-toting and unseen servants who then pumped the hot water up and through the faucets. But obviously, that was going to be quite difficult to replicate for hundreds of people. So the servants' dormitories were segregated into male and female, and every morning into each of the dormitories, cold, clean water would be provided for them to sponge themselves and exfoliate with. They also had two layers to their clothes. The heavier and harder to clean outer garments went to the palace laundries far less often, but to prevent them smelling, everyone would wear linen undergarments that would be put between their bodies and the heavier outer garments. You could launder the linen a lot more quickly and therefore more often, thereby cutting down on smells. Chalk, salt, or charcoal were also provided in the dormitories for the staff's dental hygiene. If you are ever visiting Hampton Court, one of the places which I would encourage you to start your tour with is the kitchens. Most of them date from the reign of King Henry VII, who ruled from 1485 until his death in 1509. During that time, Hampton Court was the country retreat of Henry VII's friend and court official, Sir Giles Daubeny. And the kitchens that you will see are Daubeny's brainchild. Apparently, in winter, servants kept trying to find an excuse to sleep in the kitchens rather than the dormitories because the kitchens stayed so warm throughout the night. Come summer, however, all the kitchen staff were trying to find an excuse to sleep elsewhere for the very same reason. Some people never got to leave Hampton Court if you're a believer in the supernatural, which brings us to our second bite of the Hampton Court historical story, which is that it's allegedly haunted. There are several ghosts, including one of Elizabeth I's ladies-in-waiting, Sybil Penn, who died at the palace in 1562, and a ghost that staff today tell me leaves a scent of chocolate as she sails by, which could be the spectre of Georgian chocolatier Mrs. Grace Tozier. By far the most famous of the palace's ghosts is said to haunt this corridor, the Haunted Gallery, where it is believed by those who believe that the unhappy revenant of King Henry VIII's fifth wife, Queen Catherine Howard, recreates the trauma of her downfall here in the winter of 1541. Queen Catherine was about 18 or 19 years old, we don't know the exact age, when her position as England's Queen Consort was upended by the testimony of a former family servant who revealed that the beautiful Queen Catherine had not been a virgin when she married King Henry. This was not a crime, but it was a scandal, especially when a discreet investigation at Hampton Court by the King's men revealed that Queen Catherine had hired her former lover to be one of her household staff at the palace. Acting on this information, the king ordered that his wife be detained in her apartments and, realizing that she was in terrible danger, Queen Catherine broke past her guards and ran screaming down this corridor, trying to reach her husband, who was praying in one of the rooms nearby. She planned to beg him for mercy. She very nearly made it until the guardsmen caught up with her and dragged her screaming in terror back to her rooms. For those who believe in the haunting, it's either the sound of Catherine's screams or more often a chilling feeling of dread that permeates the haunted gallery. Increasingly suspicious of her levels of panic, the king ordered a second investigation, which included a complete search of Hampton Court, which uncovered a love letter that Queen Catherine had written to a handsome courtier called Thomas Culpepper, one of her husband's favourite attendants. And it was written after Queen Catherine's wedding, at which point the scandal became a crime. Catherine was removed from Hampton Court under house arrest and later beheaded on her husband's orders, as was Thomas Culpepper. Whether or not Hampton Court is haunted by the ghost of Catherine Howard, it is certainly still haunted by her story that saw her dead on her husband's orders when she was about 20 years old. Attitudes to sex were a bit more relaxed in the next century when King James I, Mary Queen of Scots' son, who inherited the English throne in 1603, spent his first Christmas as English king at Hampton Court, which brings us to have yourself a merry little Christmas. James and his glamorous Danish wife, Queen Anna, turned Hampton Court into the partying hub of the British Isles, deliberately using its magnificent spaces to proclaim a confident new era for the monarchy with the arrival of the Stuart dynasty. The king and queen commissioned many entertainments that Christmas, including some from an up-and-coming playwright called William Shakespeare, who performed Hamlet, Twelfth Night, and Henry V for the Christmas party guests who descended on the palace for 12 consecutive days of festivities. Among those given starring roles in the productions in the Great Hall was the dashing Lord Philip Herbert, a stunningly good-looking nobleman who was described as being as handsome as he was stupid. Lord Philip took no offence at that. By his own admission, he only cared about hunting and parties, and how to attract the new king who was besotted with him. Stars Network are currently producing a drama about James I's love affair with George Villiers, starring Julianne Moore and Nicholas Galitzin. And James's list of English lovers began at Hampton Court with all muscle, less brain, Lord Philip, who appeared at a court ball in the Great Hall wearing so many of the jewels given to him by the king that he couldn't complete a dance because of the sheer weight of his outfit. Soon, however, the king fell seriously in love at Hampton Court with a fellow Scotsman called Sir Robert Carr. Handsome, like Philip, not necessarily an intellectual, but loyal, devoted to the king, and apparently great fun, Robert, I would argue, became the love of King James's life until he was ousted by George Villiers. The love affair between the king and the knight had already by then been put under pressure through the threat of blackmail from a diplomat who knew a little bit too much about Sir Robert, and that quickly escalated into one of the greatest scandals of the 17th century, one of suspected murder via a poisoned tart, blackmail, illegal imprisonment, sensational public trials, and several broken hearts and lives, which all began with a glittering Christmas at Hampton Court. In at number four is the fact that America's last king was also Hampton Court's last, in a way. How did this fabulous centre of monarchy, politics, and authority suddenly, almost overnight, cease to be a working palace? Why do the royals still not live there? Well, in 1760, young Prince George succeeded his grandfather to become King George III, and a year later, he bought a mansion in London from the Duke of Buckingham's son, called Buckingham House, which George III gifted to his wife, Queen Charlotte, and revamped as Buckingham Palace. He then declared that, unlike his ancestors, he had no interest in living at Hampton Court, and instead had some of its art and furniture removed to decorate Buckingham Palace. He also opened the Hampton Court gardens to his people as a tourist attraction, and he subdivided the empty palace's rooms into self-contained apartments, which he later gifted to relatives fleeing the French Revolution, retired servants, or widowed aristocrats. Later, George III's granddaughter, Queen Victoria, extended her grandfather's policy and began opening up the palace's major rooms to tourists, making Hampton Court the most popular museum in Britain. But why did George III leave the splendour of Hampton Court so definitively and dramatically? Well, we now know, thanks to the testimony of one of his sons, Prince Augustus, who revealed, tragically, that it was a case of domestic abuse at Hampton Court that turned George III against it. As a teenager, still grieving the death of his own father, Prince Frederick, the future George III was invited to spend time at Hampton Court with his spectacularly unlikable grandfather, King George II, who had a notoriously foul temper. One afternoon, amid the Baroque magnificence of the revamped east wing of the palace, Prince George said something which his grandfather didn't like, who then proceeded to beat his grandson so cruelly and unfairly that George III thereafter regarded it as one of the most distressing days of his life. And when the time came that he was king, he couldn't bring himself to spend time at Hampton Court again. Knowing that Hampton Court was so artistically, architecturally, and historically important, King George couldn't bring himself to let it rot, so that's why he found another purpose for it. But his trauma ended Hampton Court's career as a royal residence, and by the time George III died after 60 years as monarch, time had moved on and the royals never again went back there to live. That's not to say that they never went back. They didn't live there, but they still visited from time to time. And in 1953, young Queen Elizabeth II was invited as the guest of honour at a ball in the Great Hall to honour her coronation. Among her fellow guests were Captain Johnny Spencer, later father of Elizabeth's daughter-in-law, Princess Diana, Elizabeth's husband, Prince Philip, and her sister, Princess Margaret. But their mother wasn't there, and neither was one very important guest. Fans of modern royal history and or the hit Netflix show The Crown may remember the season one plotline concerning or inspired by Princess Margaret's desire to marry her late father's best friend, Group Captain Peter Townsend, who, after the old king's death in 1952, had stayed on working in royal service as controller of the Queen Mother's household. The Queen Mother liked her late husband's friend very much, and she sympathised with him over the breakdown of his marriage after his wife Rosemary allegedly had an affair with a London businessman. What the Queen Mother did not initially know, however, was that Peter had started a romance with her youngest daughter, Princess Margaret, and when she found out, she was horrified. She was horrified for a couple of reasons. Firstly, it's not true that the Queen Mother had a profound revulsion or abhorrence of divorce, as is often claimed. Her niece, Anne, had been divorced, and the Queen Mother celebrated Anne's marriage to an also divorced Danish prince. But when it came to senior members of the British royal family, she still had painful memories of the abdication crisis of 1936. When her brother-in-law, King Edward VIII, had relinquished the throne ostensibly to marry a divorcee. When Margaret announced her intention to marry Peter Townsend, the Queen Mother allegedly worried that her daughter would have to renounce her place in the line of succession, her public work, and that she might be expected to live abroad for a while. We also now know that privately, the Queen Mother was worried about the dynamic of the relationship, in that Margaret had become engaged to her dead father's friend not long after her father's funeral, and that this might be a grief-forged relationship that would require a lot of sacrifice from Margaret, which she might one day come to regret. From what we can tell, the Queen Mother years later felt that that might have been an overly harsh assessment of the relationship, but it does seem to be what she and quite a few other people in the royal household thought at the time. The Queen Mother, looking quite magnificent in Cecil Beaton's typically magnificent photographs, never did anything in a straight line. She tried to hide her distress and disapproval behind her relentless good manners, and the Hampton Court coronation ball gives us a little glimpse into how she did this. So rather than run the risk of Peter waltzing around the Great Hall in the arms of Princess Margaret and the romance growing stronger, the Queen Mother suddenly announced that she and her household would be attending a different party. They would go to a military veterans Air Force ball in London on the same night as the Hampton Court ball. The joke was that the reason for this declines with regrets was that the Queen Mother was subtly doing everything to make sure the romance petered out as soon as possible. So instead, the glamorous Princess Margaret attended the Hampton Court Ball and the midnight candlelight supper in the Palace Orangery, dancing with the Prime Minister of Northern Ireland, movie stars, cavalry officers, and chatting with Winston Churchill. She, in fairness, had such a good time that she didn't arrive back at Buckingham Palace until sunrise, with her sister, Elizabeth II, who had been dancing in the Great Hall with her husband until 3 o'clock in the morning. I hope you've enjoyed these five bites across the five centuries of Hampton Court's history. I've been Gareth Russell, author of The Palace, From the Tudors to the Windsors, 500 Years of British History at Hampton Court. Thank you very much.
Thank you, Gareth. That was Gareth Russell with five big ideas from The Palace, From the Tudors to the Windsors, 500 Years of British History at Hampton Court. I'm Michael Kovnat. Thanks for listening.